Live from the Regis Suites in Phoenix, Arizona, you are listening to Breakthrough Thinking. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. I'm Dave Isaac. And if it is the first Tuesday of each month from 4 to 5, it must be Breakthrough Networking, starring none other than Al Fulton, Netland Services. That was nice seeing you because I hardly see you during the month.
Yes. Thanks, Dave. Thanks for having me on the show.
Absolutely. It's your show.
Yeah. Thanks.
Wait, did I say that? Can an attorney hold me accountable for that? All right. It's our show. All right. I'm the host. You're the star. Let's
Okay. Great.
See, we just negotiated out in front of a great guest today.
Yes.
But now let's talk a little bit about your show. It's you've had some really great guests on, and today you have an equally great guest. And it's so helpful to the listeners or people that want to go back and hear the replay of the show on breakradioshow.com. Go to archives under Net One Services, or actually I should say Breakthrough Networking.
Yes.
And they can hear all these great shows that you have. And first of all, how's it going?
Things are going great. It's the beginning of the year, and hopefully it will be a very good year.
And I think it will because, well, I always say it. I can't help it. It's like an addiction. You give the best service ever. And I say it all the time because I'll just give an example in front of our guest here, Jeff, and we'll introduce him in a second. I mean, so many times I've done, you know, sometimes it's not my fault, but sometimes it's my fault, like when I tripped over the cord and the power cord got stuck into the computer, and I go, uh-oh, I only have 20% left, I can't get power. And I call Al immediately. He says, hey, I'm not a client, but come on down if you want, if you're close in the area. Yeah, I come on down in 10 seconds virtually you fixed it.
Yeah.
And that's just one example. My best example, though, there's so many of them. But the other one, here I'm at my favorite restaurant, right?
Yep.
Wildflower Bread Company. Mm-hmm. And I think my power pack went out. And I go, oh, no, I only have 20% left on, and I can't charge it. And guess what? I call Al, and he goes, where are you? I said, 75th and Bell, Avenue and Bell. He said, I'll be there in about 10 minutes. I mean, I've never heard of anything like that before. And I just got to brag about you because it's off the charts. It's like way off the charts. And of course, your staff has done similar things. I like it.
Right. Thank you so much.
And thank you, though.
Oh, you're very welcome. Our team, that's what we're there for.
And very, very good team. So I just want to brag about you. And, of course, Breakthrough Networking is about connection and networking. They're very important in business to get to know people. If they don't know you exist, how do you provide great service, right?
Yeah, exactly. And then and then how to, and that is what our theme is about, business networking, how to do it effectively, and same thing with business startup and tips and tricks, and that is why our guest is here today.
Tips and tricks? That sounds like Halloween. Oh, that's trick or treat. I got it mixed up. Tips and tricks are something else.
Oh, yes, you're right. I shouldn't have used that, I guess.
That's like Van Buren in Washington.
Yeah. Las Vegas is about
that. Or Las Vegas, too.
Your favorite place.
Yeah, I do like it.
Guest.
That is one. Well, let's introduce Jeffrey Craven, Thomas Craven, a law firm attorney, Jeffrey Craven. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're more than welcome. This is great. How do you like the show so far?
Interesting. First time on a show, so this is
Oh, really? This is great. See, our banter is good, and if Greg gets involved, he'll push the envelope a little bit.
Now, Dave, you did not tell him the three things.
That's right. Okay. I should have said it before we went on, but, okay, Greg cut us. No, I'm kidding. Greg's our producer. Well, all we do here is we have a conversation, just like we were doing with Al right now, and have fun. We want to have fun. And just at least help one person, because with insights or inspiration, motivation, hope, or you know, whatever it is, knowledge, that can help people. And that's how we do the radio show. And it seems to work really, really well. So Jeffrey, tell us a little bit about yourself, how long you've been an attorney, when did you form your firm, you have a partnership, and what you actually concentrate in. Notice I didn't say specialize in. I don't think that's the appropriate term for attorneys, just like it isn't for CPAs, but what you could concentrate in.
Right. With attorneys, you can only have a specialty if it's a certain recognized specialty within the state bar. And
exactly.
And all the other stuff. And I don't have a specialty, but I do concentrate in business law and construction and commercial litigation and real estate. You were asking about me. I've been in the Valley now for 14 years, plus or minus. came out here actually because a friend of mine that I went to law school with was working out here and invited me to come out. And I came out and interviewed for a job, and we stayed out here, and he and I eventually broke off and went in and started our own firm in 2003. And now I'm in my second iteration of my own firm with a different partner that started in 2012. It's essentially a continuation of the same firm.
Now, contract. You said you do a lot. You concentrate in contractors, construction, or
yes. When I came out here, I was working for a boutique construction litigation firm, and my bread and butter clients, if you will, have been contractors historically. I actually, as a kind of an adjunct to representing the construction industry and construction clients on litigation matters, they would, once they become a client, they're a client. They come in about other matters. And I had desired to and eventually did branch out into helping them on those other issues like their contracts and their real estate issues and a whole variety of other things, thinking it's all business-related law.
So business-related, would that include setting up the type of entity that people should be in, like LLCs, corporations, the advice regarding that?
I have probably formed at least 50, actually probably closer to 100 different limited liability companies for folks over the years.
Oh, good.
And I've done a few corporations. I generally tend to steer smaller businesses into limited liability companies.
Yeah.
It makes a lot more sense because with a limited liability company, you get the same essential legal protections that you get with a corporation.
Right.
But you have a lot more flexibility in terms of your business operation. You don't have some of the maintenance overhead that you would have with a corporation.
No question about it. And whether it's a one member LLC, it'd be so proprietor treatment for taxes, and if it's two or more, I guess I could say more than one partnership, but you could elect other type of entities if you wanted an S-corp or a C-corp.
Correct, and interesting that you bring that up. I actually don't want to step on your toes because I understand your background as a CPA, but when I first started doing these limited liability companies back in 2003, 2004, no, actually probably would have been 1999, 2000, I was coming across contractors in particular were coming back to me telling me that their accountants telling them they couldn't form an LLC because they wanted to operate under a different entity status, and I had explained to them that there's a difference between how you're formed and how you operate as a legal entity versus how you are taxed by the Internal Revenue Service.
Yeah.
And that, like you say, if you're a single individual forming a limited liability company, you can still – you're essentially treated as a disregarded entity.
That's right.
For purposes of the IRS. And that works out nice because if you're a small mom and pop operating – really just a pop, I guess, operating out of your home, you can form a limited liability company and have the protection without necessarily having to do – suddenly have, a much more complicated tax issue. You can still essentially – proceed on your Schedule C, right?
Yeah, you can. It'd be one return in your personal return versus two returns.
Exactly.
Which is interesting. And, you're right. CPAs sometimes, they sort of miss the boat. I shouldn't quite say it like that since I'm a CPA. I should say some CPAs that maybe don't keep up to date, and it may overlap their boundaries too. And you got to be careful about that. I know CPAs that actually form LLCs and corporations. And even though I don't know if that's proper or not, but I never do that because if you're a CPA, practice what you're trained to do and let an attorney do what they're trained to do. Would you agree with me?
Absolutely. I would say, I'm not going to say that it's absolutely illegal for a CPA
right.
to form an entity, but generally speaking, from my perspective anyway, that's kind of touching into the practice
yeah.
of law, which
you're really not supposed to practice outside your scope.
And I, from my perspective, I when I set up the limited liability companies, I do have standard forms that I use, but I will typically tell the client that I am an attorney, I am not a CPA, and you really should have a good CPA because when you're starting to get into the avenues of growing your small business and forming a limited liability company, things are going to get a lot more complicated than they would be in your ordinary home life, if you will. And there are things that, special areas of knowledge that a CPA is going to have about what would be, for how you want to operate your business, what's going to be the best tax approach for you.
Yeah, it is always important. I always tell people they need at least three on their team Always have an attorney. Always. Whether you need one or not, have one.
Mm-hmm.
Just make sure they're there. A CPA, an IT professional. I really believe that. It's so complex these days with computers. That's Al Fulton here. And also maybe a fourth, a business coach if they're really good. I think that's not too bad if they're really good.
Those wouldn't have been necessarily the four that I would have picked as my top, but those are all good choices and all good people to have for you. And definitely nowadays with the complexities of computers and operating, particularly if you're going to have one more than one machine, it's always a good idea to have somebody to go to, a good IT person like Al, who actually, full disclosure, he actually does work for me. So.
Oh, cool. Excellent. Well, you got the right guy, I got to tell you. There's no doubt. We love Al.
Helping me, my computers have gotten a little bit antiquated, and my Microsoft is no longer supporting some of my software or operating systems that I'm using, so I'm going to upgrade.
Oh,
but getting back to your point, one other person that I would probably list in your top is having as part of your group, your team, if you will, because ultimately when you're running a business, you are operating it with a team, whether those people work directly for you or...
I'm going to guess. Banker or insurance guy?
Insurance.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
That
makes
sense.
Good too.
Yeah.
Insurance, definitely, because
you
get big enough, you become a target.
You know, that's a good point. I appreciate what you just said, because you got to make sure you're covered and you reduce the risk. Isn't part of business about minimizing risk?
Certainly part of the whole idea behind forming a limited liability company
yeah.
is to try and mitigate and minimize some of your personal risk for business transactions. But it goes beyond just having insurance. It's having an insurance agent, because you can talk to your agent about an issue that you may have, and that agent isn't necessarily going to talk to your insurance company. And that's important, too, because sometimes there may be things you want to discuss that, once it gets reported to an insurance carrier, could have some sort of deleterious effect on your insurance mm-hmm. rates or your insurability. And maybe you need to get information before you make the decision whether to pull that trigger and actually put your carrier on notice.
So it's not good enough to have a little gecko consulting with you. You know, the little green guy?
Yes. There are a lot of guys out there that are working hard and as agents. And really, ideally, what I would say is, you can go to somebody like a Geico or some other captain or single insurer. But if you go to an agent or a broker, really, who can work for a number of different insurance companies, then you get a lot more choice as well. And you don't get pigeonholed into a product that may not necessarily be the best thing for you.
No question about it. I think that's so critical. So a common error, I think, that I see with clients is often they don't actually end, if they're forming an LLC, they're treating it, let's say, as a partnership. That's a default provision if it's more than one. Operating agreements, they don't a lot of them don't seem to have them. As an attorney, what would you say about that?
I would say that that's, generally speaking, not a good idea.
Yeah.
If you don't have an operating agreement, you have some limited protections just by virtue of the limited liability company statutes. But the whole idea behind the operating agreement, it's effectively the contract between the entity, the LLC itself, and its members, which are the two people in a partnership, for example. And you want to use that opportunity and have that operating agreement to address the kinds of things that are going to come up in your business to permit you to operate effectively. And if you fall back on reliance on the statutes, one, it's not going to cover everything, every conceivable kind of issue that's going to arise. Two, it may not address some tax issues that you would want to have addressed in your operating agreement. And three, there are the way the statutes require, meetings and membership ratios, for example. Let's go to the partnership example. Maybe you don't necessarily want to be 50-50 partners.
Yeah.
If you're within the statutes and there's two of you, there's no real way to delineate that. You're 50-50 partners by default. So having an operating agreement is definitely a good idea. Plus, beyond all of that, it's important to have the operating agreement and to probably at least once a year do a resolution so that you can do what we call in the legal realm maintaining your corporate formalities, which is an important part of the process of making sure that limited liability company is really operating as a separate business entity. And then, of course, corollary to that and getting off the topic of operating agreements is you definitely want to have a separate bank account for that entity.
No question. Why don't we take a quick break, and when we come back, I'd like to explore a little bit more about the specifics of what goes in an operating agreement, because I do think it's critical, just like you do. And I think some of these things may be new to the listeners, but we will go over some of the specifics. This is Breakthrough Thinking, and of course, Al Fulton, NetOne Services, first Tuesday of each month from 4 to 5. Special in-studio guest, Jeffrey Craven, attorney Thomas and Craven Law Firm. We'll be right back.
Beer and Baum and Spien PC, we want to help you work on your business, not in your business. We take a simple approach. You know your business. Our firm gives you the information to make those decisions better. Our firm takes a proactive approach to your accounting needs, and if you look behind the numbers, you'll find there are hidden opportunities that we try to impart on you. Communication is the key to that understanding, and there is no charge for brief phone calls. Contact us at 602-266-5633 or email us at mitch@jfbpc.com. Birenbaum and Spien works to increase your understanding of your business in order to make the decisions necessary to move your business forward.
Ridenour, Heinsohn & Lewis is a multi-practice law firm, ideally equipped to assist with a broad range of legal and business issues, corporate and financial transactions, real estate, commercial, litigation, bankruptcy, and private client practice. Ridenour, Heinsohn & Lewis is a law firm that bases its practice on understanding the businesses of their clients, and they use this insight to meet each client's unique and evolving legal challenges. Call or click today, 602-254-9900. Find them on the web at rhkl-law.com.
Do you owe money to the IRS? Have you heard of possible payment options such as a partial payment installment agreement, offering compromise, or not currently collectible status? Knowing that you have options and what those options are will greatly relieve your worry and stress. Hi, my name is Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. If you are curious as to what options may be available to you if you owe money to the IRS, my 25 years experience as a CPA may very well help you in these times of uncertainty. Stop worrying and start learning about what options you have. If you just want to talk to someone about your IRS debt or want specific advice, I invite you to call me at 602-625-3074. That is 602-625-3074. And when you call, ask for me, Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor.
And welcome back again. You're listening to Breakthrough Thinking live here at the Regis Suites in Phoenix, Arizona. And it's the first Tuesday of each month, 4 to 5, Al Fulton, NetOne Services. And special thanks, of course, for coming down as Jeffrey Craven, attorney for Thomas Craven Law Firm. We've been talking a little bit about the type of entity, specifically a bit about operating agreements. And as promised just before the break, I thought we should talk a little specifics, and we'll go to right after that to Al. There's a lot of interesting questions, I think, on contracts and things that people need to know.
Yes.
The operating agreements, as a CPA, you got to read them. I mean, you got to read. That's the Bible. That's how you're going to prepare the return. And some things like what's required if you need cash? You know, do people equally contribute cash? Distributions, how do people get money out? If it's a partnership, you cannot be an employee if you're a partner. So you need distributions, and your income will come through a K-1, your allocation. So there's things like that, 704B regs, that's special allocations that you probably put in. Does that make sense? I mean, you got to have these in there.
That's correct. You need to start off with, at the outset, with what are your capital contributions? What are each of the people who are coming into the limited liability company bringing into that company, or where is it getting its source to operate, its source funds to operate?
Yeah.
And then it just kind of goes from there. I mean, you need to decide when and how the company, if it runs short on cash, can do a capital call to try and get additional capital funds in. And then the other thing, too, is when you're dealing with an operating agreement, there are different types of operating agreements. Some are member-managed, some are manager-managed. If you're in a manager-managed operating agreement, you need to define what the authority of that manager is, you know, when they can go and borrow money for the company, or when they have to go and do a hold a meeting and get the authorization of the other members.
And for the listeners to define this, if it's member-managed, that means one of the actual members are managing it. Is that correct?
A member-managed is just I don't use them very often. Usually I only use those for like a real estate holding company where it's not going to have a lot of activity. A member-managed essentially means that pretty much any decision of the company has to be made by the members, which essentially would require a meeting and a resolution to do that. Whereas if you are operating a business where you're selling a product or whatever, you may want to have a manager-managed company where the manager would have more authority to engage in some of the ordinary business of the company without actually having to go back to the members and get authorization from them. So to put it in a corporate structure, which people tend to be more familiar with, your manager in a limited liability company is not like a line manager. The word manager is, in effect, they're really more like a president or somebody who's, probably like the president of a corporation. So kind of just to distinguish them from the shareholders, which are typically, that's more along the lines of what the members are in a limited liability company.
So if it's managed member, what you're saying is that they're not one of the owners, in essence. They're just the manager to make decisions, or could it be both ways?
Could be both ways. You can have one of the members or one or more of the members be the managers of the company, or you can have somebody who's an outside person who may not have any ownership interest in the company to act as the manager.
Gotcha. Yeah, and that's important. I think that's confusing to some people. All right, Al, what do we got? You got a whole list of good stuff to have.
It is regarding contracts, things that individuals should consider. And Jeff has a top 10 hit list, and I will let him expound.
I will say that the top 10 that I gave to Al was actually something I prepared previously, and it really is kind of focused more towards contractors as opposed to other types of businesses. Some of the things in there will be still applicable. Some of them maybe not so much. For example, if you're operating a business selling widgets, you're probably not going to be very interested in mechanics liens.
Yeah, I hear you.
But otherwise, my top 10, the thing of it, broadly speaking, a contract is essentially it's an agreement between two parties. It's basically the way that you define what your relationship is going to be. In this context, it's a business relationship. So some people say, well, I don't need to do a contract. I do everything on a handshake. Well, in effect, you still have a contract. You still have an agreement between the parties. It's just maybe it's recognized through course of dealing or whatever. But what we're focused on today are written contracts and the kinds of things that you would like to have in a written contract in order to protect your interests. And the starting point would be, to be specific, the whole point behind having a written contract is to try and define each side's expectations. And the more that you can be specific and concrete about what it is you're doing with one another, at least in my mind, less likelihood you're going to have issues down the line where you get into a dispute about what were truly the people's intentions at the outset.
So isn't it, you're saying it's really a communication tool?
Yes. Yes, it's and it's both a communication tool and it's a way to engage in a transaction. It's a way for one person to get paid and another person to get something for what they're paying, whether that is purchasing something, a phone or services or whatever.
And that brings up the point of in the being specific, if it's in writing, it can be modified by either party, and it can be stated in the contract that it can be modified by either party as long as it's submitted in a certain fashion, whether it's by letter, by mail, by email, by fax. And that should be stated in the contract. And Jeff touched on the expectation of payment, and there are different types of payment. There are different increments of payment, and the milestones. Go ahead, expound.
Milestones. All right. So if you're doing a contract, and probably the best example where milestones would come into play is some sort of service contract. You're generally speaking not going to get paid everything up front before you actually start doing the work. And by the same token, you may not want to wait until you've completed everything before you get paid, particularly if it's something that's going to be done over a fairly extended period of time. So part of what you do in the contract is you define your milestones, which are the different points by which you will get paid. And those milestones can be set strictly by a date, or they can be set by accomplishing a particular task. But again, the whole point behind it, the contract, is you want to define those points in time so that both sides are on the same page and know when the person who's doing the work should expect to be paid, when the person who is getting the services should expect to have to pay.
And there's the different sources of payments. I know there's you can expect payment by check, by credit card, by wire transfer, by some sort of I won't say a lien on something, but they can pledge something of value against the project. And let's say if they don't pay, or let's say they pay late, what would you offer or suggest in the contract?
Well, the other thing about the contract is it also, in addition to defining expectations for a positive aspect of the transaction, it also defines what's going to happen on the back end if somebody doesn't perform the way they're supposed to.
And if they're just paying late,
you may want to, and I usually do recommend having an interest clause in there so that you can have the opportunity to recoup interest. And, we're sitting here in Phoenix, Arizona right now, and different states have different requirements or limitations on the amount of interest rate you can charge. Arizona does not necessarily have a usury rate, but there is a default interest rate set by statute, and that rate has been changed now where it's considerably lower. It used to be 10%, and now it kind of fluctuates with, I think it's set to an index, and I think the last I checked it was closer to like 4%. If somebody's not paying you, you want to encourage them to pay you by having an interest rate that at least pays you for the time value of the money, because that money should be yours, and if you're not getting it, you should at least be getting some sort of interest on that money, because that's how things operate in the U.S., and if you were to borrow money from a bank, they would expect you to pay interest as well. What I like to do is to set an interest rate that's high enough that hopefully the person will decide to pay you ahead of someone else. Or the way I look at it is I don't want to be your creditor. You should have a credit card for that. So if you're not going to pay – if you want to not pay me, you're going to pay me at an interest rate that's going to be higher and your credit card rate, because I want to encourage you to use your credit card or whatever source you can to pay me.
Exactly, and that brings up the next point of in the agreement, what happens if the product isn't up to expectation or service?
Yeah. And in that scenario, you need to have, default remedies where you can define what is a default and what the person who is the non-defaulting party should be able to do, whether it's to file a lawsuit, whether it's to reject the goods and have them returned.
And
I'm not sure where else you were going with that. So.
The warranty.
The warranties.
Yes.
Well, and if you're offering a product or even a service, for example, in the construction industry, typically there will be some sort of warranty associated with it. It's not always necessary. Warranties. There are certain warranties that will apply by law, and if you are the person who is trading in the goods or whatever, the person who's making them, you may want to have your contract define what the warranties will be so that you're not subject necessarily to those warranties that exist by law. Probably, you can kind of define what your warranty term is, what you're willing to cover, what you're not willing to cover.
Absolutely, that's very key, and the timing.
Timing. I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was going by the top 10 hit list, and I thought I'd let you. I didn't go in order because I kept the subjects in like finance and interest, and then if someone didn't pay timely, and then the recourse of the individual or
are you talking statute of limitations if they don't perform? And that's a good question anyway, if it wasn't on topic or not.
Yeah, well, since you brought it up, and statute of limitation is just what it sounds like. It's a statute that's been set, and they vary by state to state, that defines the time frame by which you must bring a lawsuit to try and enforce your rights. And you can, by default, for example, in Arizona, if it's a written contract, that statute of limitations is 6 years. But you can contract for a longer or shorter period of time if you want. You need to find it, make it very clear.
And bypass the statute?
Potentially, yeah. I mean, even after an agreement's been breached, the parties can always sit down and talk to one another and work it out. And sometimes what will happen, typically, is when lawyers get involved with something like that, is they will sit down and say, all right, we wanted to have the opportunity to see if we can work this out, but we know that we have this statute of limitations coming up. We want to preserve both sides' rights. And they'll enter into a separate agreement that's called a tolling agreement, which both sides agree, I'm not going to enforce the statute of limitations in the event you file a lawsuit. And you can define what that tolling period is going to be. It basically says, all right, I know the statute's ending on today, but we want to have the next 3 months to try and negotiate. If things don't happen and we file a lawsuit 3 months from now, you don't get to come back and say, oh, well, you're beyond your statute of limitations. We've agreed that we're extending that for an additional 3 months.
Which is good to settle. And the one way you extend the statute if the other side does not agree on a tolling agreement deal is you file a lawsuit.
Well,
isn't that how you extend the statute?
Well, I don't know if that necessarily extends the statute, but at the very least, you need to file a lawsuit within the time frame permitted by the statute of limitations in order to be able to have the right to pursue your claim. But, you know, as a practical matter, yes, in some sense. I mean, once you file a lawsuit, there's
the statute can run, but you're still in a lawsuit.
Once you're in the lawsuit, you're fine. The issue you run into is if that lawsuit gets dismissed and you don't have some sort of agreement in place, you could be in a scenario where you're beyond your statute. And now we're getting into litigation aspects.
But interesting, I mean, that's why a well-drafted contract can minimize, right, lawsuits, but still there's lawsuits.
Right.
What can you do?
Right. And the one thing that I always get is I love the person will come into me and say, draft me an ironclad contract. And I say, there is no such thing. And if a contract were truly ironclad, nobody would sign it. Nobody would do anything with it because it would be stone. You couldn't do anything. You know, the whole point behind the various business transactions is it's a bit of a give and take, and there are always variables, and that's part of the reason why I tend to say contracts are like snowflakes. No two are exactly the same.
Wow, I like that. Now, you don't do family law, but there's, what is that called, a covenant marriage, I think. And I don't know if you know anything about that, but that's very restrictive. It's very hard to get out of a marriage. So when you just mentioned ironclad contract immediately, I thought of, show me a marriage that's like that. You know, it's tough. But there is that covenant. I think it's called covenant marriages, and it's like it's really hard to get out of it.
There is such a thing as covenant marriage. I don't deal in family law. Most of my interactions with family law have to do with issues that might arise in litigation. We will oftentimes name a spouse in litigation because of the fact that here in Arizona we're a community property state.
Right.
So we want to be able to get access to the community in the event that we can obtain a judgment against the other party. So hopefully I'm not talking over people's heads right now.
No, but it is interesting. Why don't we take a quick break, and then Al will get right back to some of your questions you have. And, of course, this is Breakthrough Thinking live at the Regis Suites in Phoenix, Arizona. That one service is starring Al Fulton, first Tuesday of each month from 4 to 5. Special in-studio guest Jeffrey Craven, attorney Thomas Craven Law Firm. We'll be right back.
you owe money to the IRS? Have you heard of possible payment options such as a partial payment installment agreement, offering compromise, or not currently collectible status? Knowing that you have options and what those options are will greatly relieve your worry and stress. Hi, my name is Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. If you are curious as to what options may be available to you if you owe money to the IRS, my 25 years experience as a CPA may very well help you in these times of uncertainty. Stop worrying and start learning about what options you have. If you just want to talk to someone about your IRS debt or want specific advice, I invite you to call me at 602-625-3074. That is 602-625-3074. And when you call, ask for me, Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor.
Reidenauer, Heinzen & Lewis is a multi-practice law firm, ideally equipped to assist with a broad range of legal and business issues, corporate and financial transactions, real estate, commercial, litigation, bankruptcy, and private client practice. Reidenauer, Heinzen & Lewis is a law firm that bases its practice on understanding the businesses of their clients, and they use this insight to meet each client's unique and evolving legal challenges. Call or click today, 602-254-9900. Find them on the web at rhkl-law.com.
At Beerham Baum & Spean PC, we want to help you work on your business, not in your business. We take a simple approach. You know your business. Our firm gives you the information to make those decisions better. Our firm takes a proactive approach to your accounting needs, and if you look behind the numbers, you'll find there are hidden opportunities that we try to impart on you. Communication is the key to that understanding, and there is no charge for brief phone calls. Contact us at 602-266-5633 or email us at mitch@jfbpc.com. Birnbaum and Spean works to increase your understanding of your business in order to make the decisions necessary to move your business forward.
And welcome back again. You're listening to Breakthrough Thinking Live here at the Regis Suites in Phoenix, Arizona. And this is Net One Services starring Al Fulton. Breakthrough Networking.
Yes, thank you, Dave.
Yeah.
Thanks.
What was I headed towards that one? Breakthrough something.
I don't know.
Where was I? Flashback to the 60s?
Vegas.
I think it was a flashback. Breakthrough Bikini Contest. Now I'm getting visualization.
Is that like the sports illustrated of today?
No, I think he's thinking more along with beach blanket bingo.
Yeah, exactly. Remember them?
And that's Funicello or something.
Yeah, she died. You know, she died last year.
Yeah.
That was sad. She was really good on the Mickey Mouse Club.
Right.
But that's where she started. And, of course, then went to all these with Paul Anka? No, Paul
no,
Avalon? Or
yeah, Frankie Avalon.
Oh, you know, speaking of a Frankie, you know, we do some reviews for Caesar's Palace up in Vegas. We reviewed the Million Dollar Quartet, a great musical. And recently we did one on the Jersey Boys. Ever hear of that musical?
Mm-hmm.
Phenomenal. Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. I mean, good stuff. This was one of the best musicals I've ever seen, and I have a review on BreakRadioShow.com, but it's something worth watching, the backstory of how this group got together. Very, very interesting, and I will give you a little appetizer. Joe Pesci, the great actor, had something to do with it.
Really interesting.
Yeah, it was amazing. That it was really worth seeing. I'm not kidding. People were dancing in the aisles by the end of the show.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really Frankie Valli had some really phenomenal songs
yes.
back then. And anyway, that's my entertainment review for today. Back to Alpha. No, so you got some more contractual type of
I do.
Questions?
Now, we were discussing the contract itself, and then what if there's a breach or what if there's a question. What jurisdiction, what state or what city?
Right. Part of when you're sitting down to set up your contract, if you're going to have a written contract, maybe you want to define in advance, in case there's a breach, where it is you're going to go to fight, where you're going to go to try and resolve your dispute. If you don't have something in your contract, then it kind of defaults to wherever the contract was entered into. That may or may not be the best choice for you, depending on where you are. So, and this will probably have the greatest benefit if you're dealing with somebody outside of your state and you want to control jurisdiction, so you don't have to chase them out of state to their state and follow their state laws. You can have a forum selection in your contract that says, if in the event there's a dispute, we're going to litigate in the Arizona courts, for example, or you could have an arbitration clause that says we're gonna go to arbitration through either private arbitration or even through the American Arbitration Association or one of the other arbitration entities that's out there. There are a couple different groups. I might forget the names of the others at the moment. So you have both the where are we going to fight it out, and then there's what law are we going to apply. And that's another thing. If you're operating in Arizona and you're trying to do an Arizona business and you're entering into a contract with somebody out of state, you want to have Arizona law apply because that's where your home is and that's what you're going to be used to, and that's probably what you're thinking of in terms of when you're setting out your contract.
Now, arbitration. Explain when someone should use arbitration versus litigating.
I'll start with, I'm not a huge fan of arbitration, mostly because I've found over the years that the expenses have kind of gotten out of hand. Typically, an arbitration is going to be more expensive up front than going through a court system, but the main advantage to doing an arbitration, main advantages, and there are two that I can think of off the top of my head. First of all, typically in arbitration, you're going to get through the process much more quickly. In Maricopa County in Arizona, it takes from the day you file a lawsuit to the day you get to a trial, it's typically 15 to 18 months.
Oh, wow.
With an arbitration, you can be in and out in as little as four.
Well,
how about binding versus non-binding? What do you recommend?
I'll come back to your question.
Yeah.
Let me finish the second aspect of the value of arbitration. And that is, went out of my head.
Dave, you got to quit interrupting.
I know. Things just pop in my head from the 60s.
Yeah, too many questions.
I know.
Yes. I mean, this segment could be continued, or we could have a future segment. So this is very good information.
I know. The second value of arbitration is that if you file a court proceeding, it's a public proceeding. There is a record, and especially here in Maricopa County, anybody can go to the county website and look up the case and find out all sorts of information about it. So sometimes, especially in businesses, when you're dealing, particularly if you're dealing with something that's maybe somewhat secretive, subject to some sort of trade secret or whatever, you may want to resolve your dispute without having it being public. So the advantage of arbitration is it can be very private. And the answer to your question,
binding versus non-binding.
Binding versus non-binding. Typically, with an arbitration clause, if you're going to have it, you're going to want it to be a binding arbitration. What you will have that's non-binding is a mediation, and a mediation is essentially where the parties get together and try and settle it. And sometimes a contract will have both a mediation and an arbitration clause, and you actually find it fairly regularly in real estate contracts where they'll have a mandatory mediation. It's mandatory that you go to mediation before you try and proceed with any of your other remedies like doing arbitration or a court or whatever, but it's non-binding in the sense that you can go to the mediation. You can try and resolve your dispute through a settlement process with a mediator, however it's defined in your contract, but you're not bound to actually come to a resolution. If you can't agree, then fine, you can move on to the next. You can move on to arbitration or go to court or whatever your next remedy is under your contract.
I was part of I had a client, husband, wife, they're getting divorced, and they went to mediation, so they called me in, just as a third party, as a CPA, and it didn't work. I mean, it was brutal. And I had to remain neutral because they're both my clients. Mm-hmm. And it was like a ping-pong match. I was looking this way, that way, back and forth. The problem was, in my opinion, was that until they can get the emotions out and away from the situation, if you negotiate out of revenge, it never ends. And I mean, it's craziness. And I know you don't do family law, but until both parties can really have a different awareness level and get past whatever hurt or self-inflicted hurt.
I'm sure it's that way in with business owners as well.
I've seen that too.
It's like absolutely. And although I don't do family law, I will say that I've been involved in a couple of different limited liability companies where they've gone sideways and the partners are fighting with one another, and it's every bit as bitter and as emotional as a divorce. Because ultimately, if you're in business with somebody, particularly if you're in it for a long period of time, you spend as much or more time with them than you do with your spouse.
Yeah, exactly. And
as well as becoming attached to the business and all that hard, labor of love to build it and destroy it.
Yeah, if you're doing it and you're putting your heart and soul into it, it's your baby. You want it to succeed, and to have somebody, a business partner, suddenly go in a different direction and pull the rug out from underneath you, yeah, that can be a very emotional moment.
That happened again long ago where actually both were, as a partnership, they split up, and we stood by one of the partners and the other one got another CPA. But we were called into the mediation, and their attorney was brutal, the other side. And he literally started pounding on the table doing theatrics. And then my client's attorney stood up and said, when you don't have the facts, you pound on the table. When you have the facts, you pound on the facts. You've probably heard that.
I've heard of some variation.
And it was interesting. So he made a little fun of the other attorney, but it was true. The guy had nothing.
Yeah. What I've heard is something along the lines of when you have the facts, argue the facts. When you have the law, argue the law. When you have neither, just be really loud.
Yeah, it's very very similar. And the guy literally was pounding on the table, and I thought, why am I here? So, but you must see all sorts of interesting things that come up. Every day is very different for you.
I do, and the thing is, because I have done so much litigation over the years, and business litigation in particular, you tend to get a bit jaundiced. And what I remind people when they come to see me and one-page conference, I start talking about things, and it grows and it mushrooms a bit, and they get upset with me, and I say, well, here's the thing you need to understand. I see the 1%.
Yeah.
I don't see the 99% of transactions that go really well. Day in and day out, I see the 1% that fail, and I'm just here to try and help you mitigate that risk.
Has there ever been a case, because from my perspective as a CPA, there's never anything easy. Even a simple case always has complexities. Is that how you see it too?
Absolutely.
It's amazing. It's like, will today be the first day that there's something that just sort of smoothly goes, but then the client says, oh, this is easy, and then you hear the except. Mm-hmm. What about this thing? And then boom. It runs into a whole maze.
Yeah, or this is a really simple case. It's really, it's cut and dry. I should definitely win in court, or I shouldn't even have to go before the judge, we should just go directly to trial because I know the judge will see it my way. And what we find is you sit down in the meeting with the client, and they have a very vested interest in their story, and without necessarily trying to purposely deceive you, they will leave details out.
Yeah.
And you end up spending your time trying to ferret those details out so you can give them sound advice about what's going on with their case rather than parroting back to them what they want to hear.
Yeah. Do you think attorneys, there's all sorts of attorneys, not just concentration-wise, specialty-wise, whatever, but how they view it from a principal standpoint, I'm just like CPAs perhaps. But so you as an attorney, if you found your client was not always being truthful, how big of a problem is that for you as an attorney?
If they're not being truthful with me, it's a huge problem because I can't really begin to defend their interests if they're leaving information out for me, particularly because whether they think they will or not, chances are the other side is going to discover what the information that they're hiding from me. And I think I would much rather hear it from the client and be able to prepare to address that ahead of time than to have to hear it from the opposing attorney and have to try and do damage control after the fact.
How much of a problem if you're caught off balance? You're in court, and the other side has something that is certainly knowable, that your client knew and didn't tell you, I suspect that's a problem.
That will sink your client's case, and depending on what it is and whether or not the court believes that you as the attorney didn't know, it could potentially get you into trouble with your judge as well.
See, that's interesting to me. I think there's attorneys, out there that maybe not as inquisitive, right, and curious to get information out, unless the client is just bold-faced, you know, really lying. But it's partly skill, too, I suspect, to pull that out and say, now, are you sure there's nothing else? I mean, let's go over this again. What happened here? Almost questioning your client like they're in a deposition.
Yes, and in fact, if they are going to the deposition, depending on what's at stake in the case, it makes sense to sit down with them ahead of time and kind of role play and ask them the hard questions and see what they'll do, see what their answer will be, because sometimes they will surprise you. But again, better to know that before you're in the deposition than while you're in the deposition.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I feel bad for attorneys that get blindsided, and it's usually by their client, and that is horrible.
If you're in practice long enough, it's going to happen.
Yeah.
Eventually, it's going to happen to you. But,
no
fun. And that's part of the skill of being an attorney, particularly a litigation attorney, is having enough self-confidence and enough knowledge in your particular realm to be able to kind of adapt and just kind of go with the flow and say, all right, this is the hand I'm dealt with. I'll make the best of a bad situation.
No doubt about it. Can you believe we're out of time?
I can.
This flew by, right?
Yeah,
amazing.
A lot of good information. What are your closing statement?
Closing statement.
I have to put that.
Could be contact.
Could
be contact information.
What do you want to leave with the listeners that I did not ask or we didn't discuss? What I would want to leave with the listeners, both with respect to limited liability companies and formation of contracts, is don't do it on your own. And at the very least, hire an attorney. Even if you don't hire them and give them a lot of money up front or do anything with them, even if you just have them there, the time that you think that, this is, especially if you're going outside of your comfort zone, this is a little outside my comfort zone, you can pick up the phone and call the attorney. The time you spend with him on the phone, even if you get billed for it or her, is going to be far less than the cost of dealing with the battle at the back end for something that you didn't anticipate because it's not part of your comfort zone.
No doubt. Well, how about contact information? How do they get in touch with you?
I can be reached through my firm. My phone number is 480-222-2225. The law firm, again, is Thomas Craven, PLLC. We're actually right here in the same building as Regis.
Oh, really?
Right upstairs on the fourth floor, 11811 North Tatum Boulevard, Suite 4020.
Excellent. And that, again, is 480-222-2225.
Correct.
I love that number. It's almost all twos.
Yeah,
that'd be a good
that, all twos. And unfortunately, when we went to apply for that number,
that is
10-plus years ago, then it was already taken by another law firm.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That is very cool. How do they get in touch with you?
NetOneServices.com, and that's the number one, or 602-889-7277.
And Jeffrey Craven, thank you so much for coming in.
Yes,
let's have you on again for part two. Very, very good stuff. Al Fulton, always nice seeing you. We'll be seeing you soon.
Great,
and stay tuned for The Bottom Line coming right up.